Hey there, and welcome once again to Forecast, a podcast about climate science and climate scientists. I'm your host, Mike White, Nature's editor for Climate Science. Today, I'm bringing you an interview with Valerie Maison-Delmotte, who I've been trying to interview now for some time. And as you can imagine, with someone who's as busy and in demand as Valerie is, it's been difficult to schedule this. And finally, what happened was that we were able to get together on the last day of the IPEX meeting down in Tasmania, which was a little bit over a month ago now. What that means is that we were chatting in a meeting room where there was still quite a bit of noise from the meeting as it wrapped up. So you'll hear a lot of background noise in the beginning part of the interview that kind of tails off throughout the course of the chat. We both attended the meeting, and so it was a great chance to get Valerie's perspective on the things she's intimately involved with, things like IPCC, where she's now the co-chair of Working Group 1 for the sixth assessment report, but also to talk about some of the advances that have been going on immediately since the last IPEX meeting 4 years ago in France, and then over the much longer horizon about ice core science in general. Valerie's background is pretty interesting in the sense that she began as a modeler, but then ultimately decided that there was more potential to make major advances if she was more heavily involved in the observations. But what this means is that she's still intimately involved with the modeling community and has one of, I think, the most unusually strong bonds in both of those communities, the observational and the modeling community, and works fluently with both of those groups. And is also involved in a lot of other efforts that are not directly tied to her science research, but are a clear outgrowth out of it. For example, feeling like she has something to give back to French society and to society more generally because of the generous opportunity she's had over the years to engage in curiosity-driven science. And part of that has led to, for example, children's books about climate science. It's been great to get to know people like Valerie over the years, because what this means is that we've had a few conversations, and I think Valerie's the first guest I've had who has actually taken me to task for something that we do or don't do at Nature, which is great. It's always good to be challenged on what you're doing. And in this case, Valerie expresses her concerns about the fact that in climate science and geosciences more generally, we don't publish much in terms of methodological advances, whereas in other fields, those kinds of methods advances are actually published in Nature. So it's a great chance for you to to hear from an author who's not entirely pleased with one way that Nature is doing business. Otherwise, the interview spans her interactions with some of the early people who got ice core science going, particularly in France, people like Claude Lorius and also Jean Jouzel. And then at the very end, we have what to me was a fascinating discussion about some of the problems that might exist in national academies, which theoretically could serve as the interface between the science community and funding bodies, in particular with regards to trying to get through the importance of long-term curiosity-driven science. And Valerie has some, what seemed like, pretty provocative ideas about what might be holding things back in France. And with that, let's get to it. Valerie Maison-Delmotte, thank you for being on the show today. And I've begun by my long and glorious tradition of massacring your name, so my apologies for that, but I really appreciate you being on. You were born in northeastern France, in Nancy.
Yes.
What kind of town was that when you were growing up?
I first grew up in a small suburb area and then moved to the downtown part of the city. It's a nice city with an old history. It has a classical style. It's well known for Golden Gated Place Stanislas. That is World Heritage Site.
Okay.
And not far from the German border, with us, for me, no relationship to nationality, because in my family in the past, we were once French, once German, depending on border movements.
I guess in that part of France, you're changing throughout history all the time, it seems.
Yeah,
like,
it's giving you a feeling of being European somehow. And also growing up near the Vosgesen Mountains, with a lot of outdoor activities.
Probably your grandparents were adults during World War II. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Did they talk to you about their experiences during the war?
Yes, they did.
Were they living there in the same location at the time, and did they experience occupation?
Yes, being refugees also. Moving to the free part of France, my grandmother with small three children. Also, one of my grandfather being in jail for hiding documents and the other one being a resistant for some time. So I heard about that a lot.
Were they going to the south of France? Is that
yes.
Where the Free France was?
Yeah. In the central part.
Huh. And like the Marseille Central, that area?
Berry, which is a rural area where you could find food as well, because there were farms.
And then in your own childhood, do you have a strong interest in science from the get-go, or did you kind of get into that down the road a little bit?
I liked to learn, and I liked to read, both. When I was maybe 10 years old, I was interested by archaeology very much. And people told me that was very difficult to find a job in that field. But I did volunteer excavation with a neighbor of my parents, with Roman remains in the area. And then when I was a teenager, I had an older cousin who was an engineer, and for some reason I decided I would be an engineer and go for science studies. Sometimes I found classrooms boring, and I would dream looking at clouds. And it's funny that I've been working on things produced by the history of air masses in clouds.
Yeah, it's all come back together.
Yeah.
Growing up, what were your parents doing? Were they both working full-time or not?
Yes, my parents were working full-time. They were English teachers. I apologize for them for the quality of my English.
I'm going to give them a stern talking to. Your English is fantastic. And they were French, teaching English to French students.
Yes.
And did you think this was like a great thing for you to learn, and you were eagerly attending their lessons, or did you kind of reject it because you didn't want to do?
I was very young, they used English to say things I should not understand. And I think that's the best way to motivate someone to learn a language.
What do you think they were talking about?
Time for children to go to bed.
So in 1988, you got your initial degree.
Yes.
Is that from the equivalent of a U.S. high school?
Yes. It's the degree for the end of high school. Exactly.
I've read a lot of books about France, sort of in the popular literature. And the books like Bringing Up Bébé, which is a book about how the French raised their children, told from the point of view of an expatriate. And I've read books about like A Year in Provence, things like this. The feeling you get from reading those books and also sort of French popular psychology as it's portrayed in the U.S. is that it's a wonderful place to live. People have described it as a beautiful police state, lots of regulations, very bureaucratic, but a fantastic quality of life. And I'm just kind of curious about your thoughts on how child rearing has changed in France over the interim, and then how that got you going writing children's books.
I think a specificity of the French culture is that most women work and have kids, and we have a good daycare system, preschool and school system, and after school daycare, so that it's basically feasible. So for me, it was very easy to project into working. I never imagined in a life without working.
Uh-huh.
My parents were teachers, which meant also that I saw them working at home. I think it's very different from other jobs. Seeing your parents preparing their classes, correcting, you know, the exams, etc.
Right.
You don't have exactly the same relationship to work as something outside of the daily life, of the family life.
It's just a much more integrated part of your everyday existence as working at home.
Yeah. I don't think that things have changed that much from my generation to the generation of my daughters. I don't think that our school system and culture has changed from the time I was a child to the time my daughters were children. It was, I think, somehow similar. What's different is that with my job and the job of my husband, we have much less time with the family, and often we have travel.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a completely different organization. And the fact of writing books for children, I think, is coming from being invited in classrooms, being exposed to the curiosity of the children, the curiosity of the teachers as well.
Mm-hmm.
Teachers being willing to speak about climate change, but not having themselves being taught about that. And the feeling of spending a lot of time doing that, but it was like just a drop in a river. So the books are a tool to spread more what I wanted to share.
Mm-hmm.
I have really the feeling of being lucky. I'm paid by public money, by taxpayers' money, basically, to do a job which is also sort of a passion, you know, with a curiosity-driven research on climate. Not driven by societal concerns, really curiosity. And I have the feeling that I must share our research with everybody, including the young generation. There's such a gap between what we produce and what we know in the laboratories and the general culture about climate change that I cannot live with that. Really, I mean, I have this sort of urgency sense that we need to bridge this gap and not lose time.
I think when you're writing books for children, you have a wide range of approaches you could use to do that. And we have a four-year-old, and my wife is extremely interested in children's literature, and I've read hundreds and hundreds of books. And some of them are just absolutely amazingly good and interesting for children and for adults, and I really enjoy reading them. In fact, the most successful ones are the ones that hit multiple levels. And in the US, there was a shift from books that were sort of naturalistic and exploring the delights of the natural world to having pretty deep and often disturbing insights into the interior lives of children. Books like Where the Wild Things Are and things like this. There's a real shift in children's literature. And Tommy Ungerer comes from your part of the world. He's from Alsace and experienced, I think, what your grandparents experienced. And his books are fantastic in the sense that he puts children in danger, essentially. And they have to overcome conflicts and major issues in the way that real people do. And when you were writing your books, how did you think about how you wanted to communicate this kind of topic to your target demographic?
Okay, so the books I wrote were for children aged 9 to 12, with the idea that you need to have a sense of time and space if you want to talk about climate change. And you don't get that at an early age, usually. If you look at 4 year old, sometimes when you explain to them that in an ice core, that's the layer today and the layer when they were 3, 2, 1 and before them, then you create a very intense feeling of, oh, the world existed before me. And so it's not the right age, I think, to talk about these issues. They need first to produce their own self and right. Then learn how to read a map, a few things about time, history, and then you can go into the next step. And I did that with an editor, Le Pommier, in Paris. That's a scientific editor. And I really enjoyed the way it was designed. So I always wrote books with other colleagues, even with my husband. And we were exposed to a classroom. They addressed the topic with a teacher and basically wrote questions. Hmm. So we had a half-day exchange. They asked questions, we answered, and we took notes. And each book is written with a child's question as a chapter.
Oh, fantastic.
So we wrote the books that look like sort of novels, but I'm not a writer. So it may be a little artificial, but it's not a science book, you know, it's right. A story where we put children in action. So they are like inquirers and they are active. And at the end, the same classroom, at the end of the school year, would read the book or the draft of the book and provide comments. And this is why I really like to work with children.
They're
compared to adults. They are very honest. So when they don't understand, they tell you. They don't say, oh, that was interesting.
I think when you're talking with scientists, I'm just speaking for myself, perhaps, but there's a reluctance to admit that you don't know things.
Exactly.
Because it'll reveal your own ignorance. But I think, yeah, you're right.
And that's a specificity of the French culture.
Oh, really?
If you look at a seminar, at a classroom, at high school level or university level, we are not taught to ask questions.
Hmm.
Questions are supposed to reflect how smart you are, in a way, but not acknowledge your ignorance. And that's very different from the American culture, where
yes.
You are encouraged to ask fair questions, which may suggest the speaker was not clear enough before, but at least allow a proper communication.
Getting back to your own career, I have some questions about how the French educational system actually works. I know you have this degree in 1993 called the DEA, which doesn't seem to exist anymore.
So I had a double degree, one as a grande école, engineering school, which in France is quite prestigious and it has competitive entrance. And I specialized in physics and physics of fluids. And in the same time, during the last year, I had a master 2 degree. So DEA was the equivalent of a master degree today. It's just the same.
And you were working on primarily, was it fluid dynamics, classical fluid dynamics at that time?
Statistical physics, theoretical fluid dynamics, energetics.
Was it also an original research program, or was it primarily classwork and studying?
Classwork.
Mm-hmm.
classwork and some lab experience, but limited.
So then at that point, you must have had to make a choice about whether you want to go into a technical kind of field to develop the skills you might have developed in the engineering side of this, or go more into question-based science career.
But in France, engineering schools are the type I went through is not technical. So it's more also like a business school at the same time. So people usually are engineers or managers in private companies. That's the main pathway.
Oh, interesting. Okay. From an engineering background. Okay.
From a science background. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We don't learn that much engineering. We learn science and also economics and things like that. Hmm. So it's a French specificity that also you can find in Switzerland with ETH, which is about the same as a Grande École in France.
Okay, so there are similar, very high levels in the country.
They are similar.
Yeah.
And I lost my brother of cancer when I was in that school.
Oh my goodness.
And then I realized that life is very short. And so I really made an internal work on what was really interesting for me. And since I was in high school, I had an interest for climate science. I cannot explain why. But I was reading, you know, outreach magazines like Scientific American, the French equivalent of that, La Recherche. I remember, and I had kept one example of that magazine that had interviews of people who are now colleagues, Jean Jouzel and Hervé Le Trout. I think it was from 86, where there were results from the Vostok Ice Core and the first French climate simulations with an atmospheric model with increasing CO2 concentration. And I had kept that because it had raised my interest. And so when I was in this master level, I took that thing again, looked for the people's phone numbers, called them in different places around Paris. And I got in touch with Jean Jouzel, actually.
You just called him up on the phone?
Yes, because there was no internet at the time.
But you didn't write to him. That would be the other way of doing it.
No, I called. I found the number. I called. People were so friendly, you know.
It's a very friendly community.
Yeah. I was offered the possibility to do a master thesis with a possible funding for a PhD thesis with Sylvie Joussaume on past climate modeling, and she was my PhD supervisor.
From what I can tell, so you have your PhD in 1996.
Yes.
And you are working on monsoon modeling, sort of Holocene monsoons.
I'm working on within the paleoclimate modeling intercomparison project that was started at the time. So comparing the behavior of different atmospheric models for different past periods, mid-Holocene, more intense monsoons, the Green Sahara story,
right.
But also last glacial climate simulations, which was a nice test under cold conditions, and benefiting from data compilations, so also comparisons between model and paleoclimate data.
I also talked to Stefan Kropelin a little while ago.
Yes, I knew him at the time.
Okay.
Very well.
So Stefan, as you know, has very passionate opinions about the Green Sahara.
Yeah.
And his position on the modeling is that he doesn't understand why the modeling is targeting 6,000. That's not true. He says it's because that was the insolation peak, but that in reality, the climate changes were taking place well before that, at least in the Eastern Sahara.
The reason for the choice of periods for model intercomparison was not just looking at insolation peak, because depending on seasonal or annual aspects, it's not at the same time period. It was also driven by the level of knowledge of boundary conditions, and especially the extent of land ice. And 6,000 years ago is about the time when most of the glacial ice sheets have vanished. So then you have little uncertainty about the state of the land surface.
Oh, I see. So it was also from that.
At the time, you know, think 20 years ago.
That makes sense.
Now our knowledge has improved. And at the time, it was a choice not to introduce further uncertainties by uncertain remains of ice sheets.
So you're past the Holocene sea level transgression as well, and things have more or less stabilized into the your past 8.2
I do still believe that the start of the real interglacial period is probably about that time, maybe 5,500 years ago, when ocean ice sheet interplays have finished. I mean, those resulting from the last deglaciation, at least.
We went through grad school at more or less the same time, and I think you're first senior author paper was in 1997. If I have it right, the title was
96.
Okay, well, the one I'm looking at now is Energetics of the 6,000-year BP Atmospheric Circulation in Boreal Summer from Large-Scale to Monsoon Areas, a study with two versions of the LMD-AGCM. So I'm asking you this because I had this really, it probably isn't that uncommon, but when I did my first paper, it was on plant phenology. I was modeling plant phenology.
Yeah.
And I kind of finished my master's work. And I was like, oh, well, I've solved that problem. And then I kept working on it. And by the time I wrote my last senior author paper in 2009, I just felt like we didn't know anything. It was this reverse trajectory of knowledge. And I'm wondering if you think about now where you were then. I know your primary field now isn't monsoons, but if you were to compare that paper, what you thought then, and what people think now about monsoons, how has it changed?
I think the still big questions are the same.
That the overall forcing factors in terms of the regional dynamics are still not completely understood.
Sure, yes.
Yeah.
And the mismatch between reconstructions and simulations is still there, but now we have the capacity to run longer simulations and so explore the sort of memory of the system. Mm-hmm. You know, in the past, before that period, you had more intense monsoons due to a number of reasons. And then because you had wetter surface conditions and land surface feedbacks, it could also be self-sustained. Mm-hmm. So these issues can now be explored and they couldn't at the time.
When you were working with the LMD model at that time, did you already know that there were these components that you just mentioned that were limiting your ability to get a robust answer?
Sure. I was working with atmospheric only models. I made tests by playing really with my hands with patterns of sea surface temperatures, homemade reconstructions.
Oh, okay.
I was perfectly aware not to have an ocean model coupled to the atmosphere. And some colleagues were starting to play with land surface schemes. Nathalie Denoble, for instance, in my group. And some of them have continued to work on that and really made progress by including new components and having more comprehensive Earth system models, not just atmospheric models.
So when you got into school, you mentioned that you called up Jean Jouzel, who's, of course, one of the most famous ice core scientists in the world, but also, from the little I know of him, an incredibly nice guy, very generous and interested and still
and
fully
humble.
Engaged.
And humble.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Was he the one who really drew you into ice core science, or was it the broader environment at the time that drew you in?
There's a whole context. So at first I was not sure I would like to be a scientist. I wanted to try, so that was a master thesis, a PhD thesis, and then I sort of got caught into that. So after 2 years I sort of made up my mind that I really wanted to go on in that field. I was very lucky because the laboratory where I work, LSE, was being built, a part of it was being built at the time, so there were many open positions. And I was very lucky that Jean Jouzel had the possibility to hire someone just at the time I was finishing my PhD.
This is 96?
96. Uh-huh. Also lucky that another potential candidate managed to be hired at CNRS by a competitive exam at the same time. You know, it's a succession of things.
Seemingly random events.
And
right?
I was hired by Jean the day after my PhD thesis defense.
Wow.
But also what was clear for me was that I didn't want to go on with just intercomparison of models. I wanted to work more on the data production side, maybe with a frustration that it was very hard to identify what could be a discovery by this type of research, comparing different models and trying to understand which process was better represented today that had an influence in the past or vice versa. And so I had the idea that maybe I could be more satisfied with my work on the data producing side. And now I happen to publish most of my work with climate modelers too. Because you need both, actually. The way I describe it, I think climate science is really like a jigsaw puzzle. In fact, a 4D jigsaw puzzle from the depths of the ocean to the top of the atmosphere and
yes.
With time, you know? Mm-hmm. And each thing is a piece to the puzzle. Sometimes pieces, key pieces are missing, and sometimes minor pieces are missing.
I guess the other part of the jigsaw puzzle is that you're often unaware that there are missing pieces. In some cases, that might be one of the major problems. We're not problems, but the ongoing challenges of science.
I would not say it like that. I would say some people outside the climate science community tend to describe this field as a playing card castle, you know? And it's very different from a jigsaw puzzle, because you don't need to have all the pieces to have the big picture.
That's exactly right. It isn't a house of cards, no, which
it
can
isn't.
Easily be pulled down by yanking out one area.
Yes.
Jigsaw puzzles. As you say, the human mind is incredibly good at picking out patterns from incomplete data. And I think that climate science is in some ways similar to that. And as we go farther.
And also, I think the other image I use is the image of an impressionist painting. You know?
Sure.
When you look very close to one part of an impressionist painting, it looks uncertain, it looks complex. But then when you take a distance, you see the big picture. And I think a lot of our work as climate scientists is trying to change all the time from looking at a small part with our own work, and then taking distance and looking at the big picture by combining observations, modeling, process studies. We are all doing that all the time.
That's one thing that kind of amazed me about looking through your publication list, is that you have this breadth of work going from very, very detailed process level work up to the biggest questions in climate science. And do you think that's just a feature of you as an individual, or is it part of the French system, or do people like Jean Jouzel encourage that in you?
I think Jean Jouzel is very good at taking the best out of people by putting trust on them first. You know, it's a very stringent pressure that someone like Jean is trusting you.
Yes.
The other point is that I was very glad that I could have my curiosity-driven research through time and opportunities from different funding schemes. At first, you know, the basic funding that went through our laboratory, and we were free. We could decide what to do. We didn't have to write a proposal. You know, we could decide to focus on this or that. And I think that's the best working conditions ever, because after that, the system changed, and we have more and more of this project funding, where we have to spend a lot of time writing proposals, a lot of time evaluating proposals, and much less time to do our own research. But still, I mean, I was able to work out through these changes. And I also was very lucky that all the time I was working in an international context. So my thesis was the Paleoclimate Modeling Intercomparison Project with a very cooperative and constructive spirit. Mm. And it was the same for the IceCore work. I arrived at the time of the EPICA European project with also this spirit of cooperation. Okay, also some competition, but a friendly competition. You know, the one that takes the best out of what exists.
Yes.
Not the one that leaves someone on the side of the road if he or she has not been the fastest.
So in the early days, and I'm just going to try to mangle the name of your institute, which, as I do with all French, so it's La Laboratoire des Sciences du Climat et des L'Environnement.
Yes.
That was pretty horrible, I'm sure. But it's also from the Commission for Atomic Energy or something like that.
Okay, so my laboratory belongs to also the French Institut Pierre-Simon Laplace, IPSL, which is usually worldwide known for the acronym of its climate model. And then it has three supervising bodies. One is a CEA, that's the French Atomic Energy, and also working on alternative energies. That's my own employer. And then CNRS, that's the French National Research Center, University of Versailles and Saint-Quentin, and now a new layer, which is a very big university we are building south of Paris, which is Université Paris-Saclay.
What's the motivation to build that new university?
It's to integrate across these grandes écoles, engineering, business schools, and two universities, Versailles and south of Paris, and to have a critical mass to be visible at the international level.
And did you find it to be a collegial environment for women going into it? Were there ever any issues for you starting off in that?
I never had any issue.
That's fantastic.
Sometimes the feeling of, you know, being the only woman in a men's world where these men are very friendly to you and encouraging. And in our laboratory, we always had many women as role models in the laboratory. And in the French research system, I saw no official barrier for women. But I could feel this glass barrier effect.
A glass barrier.
Glass ceiling,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where we have much fewer women as professors than assistant professors, and fewer women as head of departments or at highest positions. There are lots of reasons behind that. But if you would like to do it, you can do it.
Mm-hmm. And now you've done it. Now you're the, well, I shouldn't say the most powerful person in all of climate science.
No.
But you have recently taken on is it called the co-chair, is that right, of the
yes.
IPCC Working Group 1?
I was elected as a co-chair, yes.
First of all, congratulations, that's a fantastic role. I talked to Matt Collins about his work in the IPCC, and he said that it's like getting drunk and having a hangover, like you swear you will never do it again. And then a little time goes by, and they go, well, I'm just going to have one beer. But I feel like the French, you know, the French don't really do binge drinking from what I know. So maybe it's a different experience for you. How did you decide, first of all, to go from your involvement in the previous IPCC reports and to kind of go for this role?
I can just express that I was not aware of IPCC for the first report. The second one was published when I was a PhD student, and I found it super useful as a sort of entrance gate to other domains of climate science to have an idea of the state of the art, find interesting papers, and then look at the tree of publications for updates.
Right.
And then the third one I used a lot for teaching, the 2001 report.
Wow, the actual report itself, not the technical summary.
Yeah, I used the report for teaching.
You're very brave.
And I read all of it. And then I decided to apply as an author for the fourth report. I promised my husband I would never do that again at the end, because actually the workload was much higher than what I expected. And it was on top of my own research and teaching and things like that. But then when you have finished the process, you realize how much you have learned out of that, especially by broadening your area of curiosity, and also by probably the high standards in going from data or simulations to conclusions. You know, the scrutiny to science, I found that extremely powerful.
Just in terms of how seriously people took the work and how rigorously they approached that process of going from the...
Yes, and having multiple eyes screening the literature and with a very critical mind, which is really what is an assessment, understanding the roots for divergence between different studies, etc.
Something I wonder about in IPCC is that, of course, in any field of science, you have debates about any number of topics, but IPCC can't just present all the working hypotheses as though they're equally valid or that they're potentially all correct. You have to some degree, as you say, assess and argue amongst the authors and try to reach what you see as the most likely way forward in this. I don't know, you could have any number of topics on sort of Arctic teleconnections to mid-latitudes. I'm sure will be an issue that will come up in the sixth report. Can you talk about what that process is like, where you have competing hypotheses and you need to get to an actual synthesis?
I think it's really how science works. But usually you are on a very narrow thing. You do it with your own direct colleagues in your lab. And there you do it with the best experts of the field worldwide. So it's really looking at the coherency of the different lines of evidence, the gaps, and they are present. The questions that you cannot solve with what you have in hand at the moment. One example, I think for the last assessment report, I was not in charge of that part, of course, but that's the discussion about the changing rate of warming of the last decade, something sometimes referred to as a hiatus.
The pause.
And the issue at the time was that actually simulations really initialized by the state of the climate of the time were not available. So when you compared historical simulations and projections with actual data, you couldn't reach clear conclusions. Mm. And since that time, maybe 40 or 50 high-level studies have been produced and continue to be produced that provide key explanations. They were not available at the time. So that's one example of a difficult situation where you don't have all the elements to understand what's happening.
Or it could have been an AR4, the dynamic contributions from ice sheets was in a similar state at the
exactly.
time. On the topic of the hiatus, the work by James Risby has shown that if you synchronize the models, you take the models that have the right ENSO phase, for example, then you actually do a fine job of simulating the observations.
Yeah. The point is that the changing rate of global warming is a conjunction of internal modes of variability. And so if you would like to be able to compare the performance of climate models with the data, you need to initialize the simulations with something that is more representative of the real climate state. And this line of work was not available at the time of the AR5.
One thing that struck me about the current report that you're working on, but also the previous one, so Thomas Stocker was one of the science leads there. You both come from a paleoclimate background, but the main rationale for IPCC is to inform policymakers about what to do about ongoing climate change and mitigation. Why do you think that that's worked well? I mean, it hasn't been a problem as far as I know, but I would have thought going into it that they would have taken people who are working on current and future climate simulations directly as opposed to paleo people.
What I think is that I was elected because the plenary, so the government representatives and their advisors thought that I could be able to do the job. It means that they trust the fact that when you have solid background in past climate at, let's say, local to global scale on different time scales, then you are able to lead an assessment. Because actually the co-chairs don't do the work. The work of the IPCC reports is done by the authors. What's really critical is to facilitate their work as I explained before, and you had the image of the hangover. many authors experience a heavy workload, and it's a heavy workload on the whole climate science community, especially those working on present day and future change, the modeling groups, the observational groups. It's a really heavy workload. So I think we are there to facilitate their work, develop tools that make it as easy as possible, and also attract the best scientists worldwide to do the assessment.
Is that difficult to attract them?
In the last two reports, there was a growing number of applicants, I understand, because I was not involved in the selection, and excellent scientists. And I hope that we can keep that. One issue for Working Group 1, for which we have been criticized, is that we are the working group with the smallest representation of scientists from developing countries. And climate science, physics of the climate science, is a science that is expensive. You need several scientists, not just one, a critical mass. You need satellites, campaigns, field campaigns, computing centers. But at the moment, we can see a development of climate science in many developing countries, especially emerging economies. I really wish that the brightest minds from these new excellent centers worldwide will be willing to contribute and will be supported by their research centers or governments. That's very important for me, that the IPCC process is able to have a broader representation of the strengths of the scientists.
The same critique is often leveled at Nature, that we publish primarily East Asia, Europe, and North American science. And I think it's absolutely true. So we're having the same issue. We publish almost nothing in physical climate from, for example, sub-Saharan Africa or large chunks of South Asia or even South America. But from what you're saying, it sounds like there's actually progress being made in those areas, but there might be a lag of...
I mean, look, China has developed climate modeling centers and all sorts of aspects. India is developing their own climate model with a focus on monsoon. Brazil has invested a lot in spatial studies and all aspects of climate science. So I know that they have bright minds. I think our role as IPCC Bureau members is to make information available so that they can apply, they know they get the information right. I hope that their research centers, the directors will facilitate their work, and you need to be supported, because when you do some volunteer unpaid work as an IPCC author, you have less capacity to do your own research, supervise your students or teach. So you need to be supported.
We're talking at the end of the IPICS meeting, the International Partnership in Ice Core Science, if I had the acronym correct. This is a sort of late afternoon on Friday. You've kindly agreed to talk to me. You talked a little bit about the IPCC at the end of the meeting, and you said that you have 31 proposals for special reports, which it sounds quite daunting, but it sounds exciting because I know that people really liked, for example, the SREX report that was put together. And that there's been a lot of clamoring for those kinds of targeted reports that people see as being, for one thing, more digestible than the full reports. And I think you're the only person I know who's actually read the entire report. what do you see as being...
Of several working groups.
Do you see a lot of potential for those kind of special reports? And is that going to be a major new area of growth for IPCC?
So some people were wondering after the AR5 whether there would be room for another IPCC report, with a lot of questions about the format and the timeline and so on. And the fact that we got 31 proposals from governments and associated bodies is a good proof that there is a huge interest in what IPCC can provide in terms of assessments. Of course, it's impossible to provide 31 special reports, but these are all very, very well-thought suggestions of topics often at the interplay between the different working groups that need to be considered for the scoping of the whole report, for maybe also expert meetings and workshops, and some of them might be covered by real special reports. Within the IPCC Bureau, with the co-chairs of all the three working groups, with the vice chairs of each working groups, we have really worked hard to provide a scientific basis for the plenary to take decisions on these 31 proposals. Results will come out by April, I think, 14, from the Nairobi next plenary meeting in Kenya.
Oh, so just a month from now?
Yes. Also, I would like to stress that, you know, we had in this ICECORE meeting a discussion about communication and two-way communication, where scientists provide what they know,
right,
but also they hear the questions of policymakers or the general public.
Or 9-year-old kids.
Yes. And I think the IPCC is structured to do that, because governments put on the table their expectations for topics like special report proposals. They also do that ahead of the scoping process of the full assessment report. Then it goes into a discussion with scientists on what science is providing, and this leads to the structure of each report. And the scientists do their work freely within each chapter until the summary for policymakers. And then again, we have this dialogue at the approval sessions of the summary for policymakers on what's clear and not clear, but also what's sometimes problematic to hear for some policymakers about what we can provide as scientists. So I think we have this sort of two-way dialogue in a structured way with this process of scoping and then approval.
I was talking to Nathan Bindoff and Philip Boyd, and they raised a question which is kind of on this vein, which is that there's been a very large focus in IPCC, at least I think from the public perception, that it's important to say what we do know. And they did a very good job on that. But from the perspective of, for example, CSIRO, which is going through these massive cuts, what that allows to happen then is a CEO to come in and say, the science is settled. And what they were arguing to me is that it would be interesting to argue like what we actually don't know. What are the major challenges facing society that we really have to confront and that are important but not known?
And I think there's a confusion sometimes about what to expect from IPCC. IPCC is not performing science, and there are other bodies at the international scale that develop this strategic vision about what is critical to better understand where are the gaps, where are the research focus for the future.
Like WCRP.
Future Earth or WCRP. And I'm very glad as a working group one co-chair that we have this structure at the international level for climate science. It's different for adaptation, for instance, where so far you don't yet have such a structured international community. So WCRP has developed these key challenges that give a good sense of, you know, what are the unknown parts of how the climate system behaves and reacts to perturbations. And also, if you look at the IPCC reports, we are not allowed to be prescriptive. So it's not possible to write, we need more research on that and that topic.
Right.
But in each chapter, what you find at the end is a sort of statement about research gaps. It's, you know, looking at the same coin and the two sides of the same coin.
Right.
Because if you identify research gaps, then you know what are the questions and the strategies for the future. And if you search in these gap sections for the keyword Antarctica, for instance, you find it at many places, you know? Antarctic sea ice, very short records. Internal variability that is larger than in other parts of the world on multi-decadal to multi-centennial timescales. What would be the reaction of the Antarctic ice sheet to future warming? Even the Antarctic surface mass balance is associated with quite a large uncertainty. So you can find that if you want to. If you are the CSIRO CEO, the IPCC report is available freely online. It's just 1,500 pages for working group one, but at the end of these chapters, you find the key gaps identified by the scientific community.
Let's turn a little bit to the meeting that we both just attended, this IPCC meeting. And as you know better than I do, Nature and Science have a long tradition of publishing high-profile papers on ice core science going back for decades.
I hope it's not a tradition. I hope it's motivated by the relevance of the findings.
It is motivated by the relevance of the findings. And I've had discussions with people actually several times now where when I talk to people, they raise a concern that, well, it isn't really a concern, it's an observation that ice core science, and probably all science, goes through big waves, where you have the initial sort of discovery by people like Willie Damsgaard that you can actually do this. And then, you know, Loris is doing it in Antarctica, and you have this explosion of papers that are just finding the science, which is so interesting. And then you have the longer records, the 400,000 year records and the 800,000 year records. And then it seems like the field get a little bit, kind of had a lull perhaps, and now it's ramping back up for the oldest ice.
I don't think so, because in fact, what you can also see is that the different countries are not in phase in big projects. So, for instance, I saw the wave of projects associated with the EPICA in Europe. And then you can see the wave of projects with the large Greenland projects, the NEAM and others. And then you can see the wave of results with the WISE Ice Core project from West Antarctica with the US. And probably we will see the wave of results from the Chinese project at Dome A, Antarctica.
Yeah.
So what's interesting with the ice core science is you have these parallel projects that still continuously produce really new findings. Also, what's interesting with the ice core science is you have information at the local scale, local climate, glaciological scale, ice sheet climate interplay, and then at the regional scale, through aerosols or second order parameters that are related to air mass trajectories and large scale circulation. And there are a number of new results emerging in this pathway. And then you have the global information with atmospheric composition.
From CO2 and methane.
Yes. And because we have these kilometers of ice cores from the past operations stored in cold rooms, each time someone has a new technique or new idea, then they can also use these precious archives to make new measurements and develop new understanding. So I don't see it as you say, like there's a big project and then the end. I see parallel important projects. Mm-hmm. And the specificity is that these projects take time. From the moment you have the idea to you convince the funding agencies and you have the logistics, it's several years, sometimes decades, from the start to the end. So I don't see it as a wave. I see it as a continuous effort. Mm-hmm. And also having more and more measurements on a given core gives more value to the samples. Because if you are looking for an event for a specific time period, then you know exactly where to go. You're super efficient at finding the right piece of ice to make it speak, basically. So I also see that as increasing the value of the samples in a way. I tried to explain to my teenagers why I had to come all the way to Tasmania. And I tried to explain that it was the Olympics of ice cores without throwing the samples by themselves. It's amazing in 4 years to see what has emerged. It's really impressive. With the development of new techniques, with the new samples that have been obtained, the new understanding of how the signal is being produced. It's really amazing. And also this new generation of extremely bright minds. I've been really impressed by the quality of the early career scientists.
They're
really very impressed. And in 1 year, they provide as much information as sometimes 20-year work in the past.
Jim White made the comment about after one talk on methane from the recap ice score, he said, it's so amusing. Wait, so what do you say? He's so cute that you think that this is normal. And you've taken the core a few months ago in season of 2015, and you're already presenting the full methane record. It's quite amazing.
And what was not that much shown here was also the whole integration, because the past climates are not just ice cores. And so the whole integration between what we can learn from the ice cores, the pros and the cons, and what we can learn when we combine with deep sea cores, with continental archives, the statistical methods that are being developed to combine these different lines of evidence for dating, for regional reconstructions, and so on. And also what's being developed in comparisons with climate model or Earth system models and ice sheet models. So this gives much more spread to what comes out of the ice cores by themselves. Sometimes I have also the feeling that the high-profile journals like Nature or Science, when they are interested in paleoclimate, they are more interested by the story than by the method. And I would like to express also sometimes the frustration that in this field, some of the key developments are methodological, like for chronologies, let's say new type of ice sheet models that account for ice deformation. And I would very much like sometimes high profile journals also to give a showcase to these methodological breakthroughs that are critical. Yeah. I remember at the last IPCC conference, I think I asked you about how you handled paleoclimate research when compared to physics. Mm-hmm. And in physics, there's a room for methodological developments that we don't have for climate science in general.
It does vary by field. So if I think fields like stem cells or genomics have a different threshold for methodological advances than we do in geosciences. We don't normally publish, as you just said, methodological advances. And from a very cynical point of view, it's a little bit too bad because the good ones are also heavily cited. And that's never our main concern about what to do with the paper or not. But I take your point that we don't publish in methods, and it is important.
I think it's important not for us, because I like all sorts of journals, but it's important for outside scientific communities that never read climate science journal or ice core science journals, only the multidisciplinary journals.
Right.
And so they don't have a chance to be exposed to what is progress in that field, apart from having conclusions from one new bit of ice somewhere.
Yeah. I don't envision a change in that. What I do see, though, is, for example, the paper by Pablo Ortega that we published a little while ago had a lot of what you've just been talking about, which is this integration of multiple records, including ice cores, and then the constraints by the modeling as well to try and come up with a good reconstruction of the North Atlantic Oscillation. So the main conclusion for us is still the reconstruction of the North Atlantic Oscillation, but it did have a lot of methodological advances.
Yeah, that's true.
One other thing, speaking of methodological advances, that I've been very interested in this meeting is the issue of the age models. So age models are always a huge issue in paleoclimate, but it seems like people are actually making some really fundamental progress, or potentially, by linking speleothems with the ice core.
And also using volcanic markers, TEFRA, as a tool to synchronize all sorts of records. And I don't see that as just restricted to past climate history as itself, so that we can look at leads and lags and how the system operates from one state to another one. I also see that as fundamental for linking past climate variability to impacts of past climate on environment and also on societies and cultures sometimes, thinking of prehistory aspects. So there's a whole thing that is really changing. For me, at the same time as we have a lot of new information, for instance, on past migrations, that needs to be placed in a common framework. So not only, you know, ice core research, but more broadly, a common framework for, let's say, evolution, you know, and climate variations at the scale of the last climatic cycles.
I think that we've probably annoyed at nature a large part of the climate and migration community, because we don't typically have those papers reviewed because they're extremely qualitative, and you'll have sort of evidence from archaeology with some carbon 14 dates, and you'll have evidence from climate. And in general, the conclusion that climate and civilization are linked is, to me, not surprising. You have to get down to a very specific conclusion, and usually involving modeling about things like food production and things like that. And the community is moving in that way. But do you see a lot of potential from the advances in the age model work in the on the climate side to push that forward?
Yes, for instance, knowing where you had the wet phases in the Arabic Peninsula and the first time when modern humans get out of Africa to the Asian area. That's a period I like. It's probably the Eemian, you know?
Right.
and having a common chronological framework there where we can also play with biological data on DNA to look at times of dispersal and things like that. I mean, there's really potential for convergence there.
That would be hugely powerful. Mm. Another issue that came up and that got the audience really excited was the CO2 offsets among the ice cores in Antarctica. I think I came to nature a little bit after this whole debate took place for the Greenland ice cores, but people don't really do CO2 in the Greenland ice cores because you have this really big unknowns about what's causing those variations. And it seems like the CO2 offsets in Antarctica on the order of sort of maybe 5 to 10 ppm, but some suggestion that they're actually increasing as you go back farther in time, not infinitely, but it could be up to 10 ppm. What's your sense of that as an issue? Is that really a big issue for the community, or is it sort of down in the details?
I think it's a fact. So that's really the interest of having multiple records and multiple groups working sometimes on the same record so that we can have a firm intercomparison and assess what's the accuracy of the measurements and then analyze what can be the cause for the spread when it's real. And so we are just at the start of that for Antarctic ice cores, I believe. What's nice is that the spread is really limited so that it's not that relevant for changing analysis of leads and lags and not that important for CO2 as a radiative forcing. That's really the methodological critical part. And I was very glad to see these first results showing also the limitations to the accuracy of the records that can be provided.
And there was a lot of possibilities thrown up on the last slide in that talk where you could have in-core production. There's a whole list of possibilities and they're just in the beginning of trying to figure it out. But
yes, and also you can see that there's emerging literature on more chemical species being measured along ice cores, better understanding potential in-situ reactions. I can see a whole field there. I think there's this awareness that the surface snow can act as a chemical reactor, which is also important for atmospheric chemistry above the snow itself. It's still hard to have a clear picture of past changes, but there's a whole research path there, both north and south.
Probably the big theme of the ice core community going forward from multiple groups, from Japan, from China, from the US, the European community, from the British Antarctic Survey, is this search for the oldest ice. So the oldest ice from a traditional ice core is about 800,000 years old. From the chainsaw cores, the horizontal blue ice cores, you have sort of ice that's a million years old, but very large age uncertainties. So people would love to get this ice. Why do people care, and do you think we'll get it?
I think we'll get it. It will take time. It's the first ones that have the potential to drill very old ice are the Chinese at Dome A. Mm-hmm. They might be lucky. Who knows? Because the deepest part of ice sheets is really complex, and we don't have tools yet to anticipate the age fully in the bottommost layers.
And they gave a 500,000-year age uncertainty.
Yes.
It's big.
So you can be lucky. I think probably at Dome Fuji, close to the Japanese ice core, within a few tens of kilometers, there was a potential to reach longer.
Well, that one seemed dangerous too, because there's so much meltdown there, and the geophysical modeling shows you have this...
It's a very complex topography.
Yeah.
And then very close to Dome C also, you have the potential to reach older ice, and many colleagues are developing new methods to try to better assess where to find it. So I do believe we will find it, but it will require probably try, fail, and try again. And then the second point is what do we look for? And that's easy to explain. I mean, the last major climate reorganization was from frequent and not intense ice ages about 1.5 million years ago to longer and more intense ice ages since about 800,000 years or maybe before. Mm-hmm. And we don't know why there was this major reorganization.
So this is the transition at the mid-Pleistocene from the so-called 40,000-year world to the 100,000-year world.
And it's a matter of atmospheric composition and greenhouse gas content, of interplay between ice sheets and climate, and possibly also some history of erosion caused by successive ice sheets in some areas. So it's really crucial to at least have information on global atmospheric composition.
So we know extremely well, I shouldn't say extremely well, but we know pretty well from the benthic forearm record, Delta Wittin record, that people like Lorraine Zeke have put together, that this shift took place. We know from a variety of proxies that the CO2 was sort of quasi-modern during the mid-Pliocene warm period. And we know that during the Pleistocene ice ages, it's gone from something like 180 to 280, you know, somewhere in there, but hasn't really gotten above 300 ppm. So we know that there must have been some kind of a step change going from the mid-Pleistocene to here.
So we need to know about dust. We need to know about methane, for which we have absolutely no other constraints. Dust, we have information from marine cores.
Yeah.
We need to know maybe about the Antarctic ice sheet topography. Having maybe some information about ice thickness change could be useful.
From total air content or something like this?
Yes. If air is left in the deepest part of the ice. Yes. I mean, the case is clear. It's very frustrating for scientists to have identified a mystery. Very frustrating. And because we have very little information, it's even not possible to try to model it fully. Okay, you also need to have information on atmospheric composition to be able to have confidence in your simulations.
So yeah, the models at that point would have way too many degrees of freedom and their boundary conditions to say anything useful, I think.
Exactly. Having information also about Antarctic sea ice could be interesting at the same time.
That would be tremendous.
Yeah. So I do believe that the case is clear, that it's feasible and it might take time. But I really wish I will be able, maybe, who knows, to go in the field with one of these projects, because I was never in Antarctica so far.
Me either.
I was twice in Greenland for the North Grip and Nima ice cores, but never in Antarctica, which is somehow frustrating, because I've played with data, but never been there.
I was talking to Jérôme Chapelas at the meeting banquet, and he said that the best time to go would be November of 2017 if their preliminary work was okay. I guess it'd be incredibly cold, but they would actually be drilling for it at that point, potentially.
Yes, and the development of the fast drills will be critical for this quest.
There's been this is sort of a timely question with the CSIRO budget cuts that have gone on, but other things as well. When you talk to policymakers or funders, how do you pitch the all this ice kind of funding question? So it's $30 million, a very, very expensive project. The basic science question is absolutely clear. But it seems like there's more of a move both here and in the EU to do more adaptation and mitigation relevant science. Do you try and pitch it that way, or do you focus on
basic
science?
I'm not in a position to do that at the moment, but I'm part of, for instance, the French National Research Council that's advising the French government on research strategy. As in every other country, there's this wish that investments in research are expected to very quickly create jobs, basically, or increase one country's competitivity. Yeah, you can feel that, I mean, everywhere.
Yeah.
And so I think Scientists from different backgrounds and me, we were very concerned about this evolution. And we made a clear case that we also, in parallel to that, need to have long-term projects and investments in basic science. And it's not only a matter of climate science, it's also astrophysics and many other fields. Probably what is missing at the moment is having space between high-level policymakers and the science community to exchange views about unknown unknowns, you know?
Absolutely.
And so that they can have confidence in providing funding in sometimes difficult economical contexts so that curiosity-driven research can progress and continue. I do believe that there is a gap in how a lack of interactions between policymakers at high level, parliament level, prime minister level.
Does that mean that we need to have more scientists at that level, or does it mean that the current scientists need to do a better job of getting to know the upper level policymakers?
It must not be on a personal basis. It has to be on an organized basis. I believe that maybe I would expect academies of sciences to be tools to play that game. It's not the case in some countries. So we need to find bodies, you know, of wise people that can also attract attention on long-term research questions. And each time there's a new government, for instance, or for new generations of policymakers, etc., to have a space to express the research needs.
We saw a film earlier in the week about the life and science of Claude Loréus. And in discussions about Claude Loréus with other French attendees here, I learned that even though he's a member of the French Academy, he won't go to the French Academy because he's extremely unhappy with the positions they've taken on climate change. When you have that kind of climate, and those are the bodies that could do the most good in terms of trying to bring forward climate science and its relevance, how do you personally think about that?
I think it has to do with the renewal rate of academies of sciences where you are nominated for life. Emergence of climate science, which has occurred in the last 40 years in a sort of modern way. So I think we have an issue there in the representation of some of the research communities. I don't have a clear answer to that. It's a good opportunity to also give a tribute to what Claude Loréus brought. He wrote a recommendation letter for me when I was recruited. I'm very grateful to him for that. And I hope to be able to do the same, which means to help the young generation to have the means to do high-level research and curiosity-driven free research.
Valerie Masson-Delmotte is the co-chair of IPCC Working Group 4 AR6 and a children's book author, and has worked with some of the most famous discourse scientists in France and all the world. Valerie, thank you so much for the conversation.
Thank you.
And that was my interview with Valerie Masson-Delmotte from LSCE and the new IPCC co-chair for Working Group 1. Valerie, thanks again. If you have any comments or feedback, you can reach me at forecastpod@gmail.com. The show notes are available at forecastpod.org. You can find the podcast on Stitcher or iTunes. You can subscribe to it there. If you subscribe, you'll get the episodes right when they're released. Can be a few hours to up to a day before they're available through iTunes directly. And if you're so inclined to leave a review, that's most welcome and a great way to get the podcast to more listeners who might not otherwise find it. Thanks for listening.